It is Monday, October 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Pittsburgh mourns the loss of 11 people shot dead at a synagogue. German Chancellor Angela Merkel acknowledges her political career is approaching its end. And the new film, Hunter Killer, depicts 21st century naval warfare. It's all ahead. The suspected gunman in the deadly attack at a synagogue in Pittsburgh, 46-year-old Robert Bowers, is due to go before a federal judge Monday. He's facing 29 federal charges, including some federal hate crimes, and could face the death penalty if convicted. Thousands of people gathered Sunday for a memorial service where religious and civic leaders came together with a message of resiliency, tolerance, and unity following the attack at the synagogue that killed 11 people. Rabbi Jeffrey Myers of the Tree of Life Synagogue spoke at the memorial service about the shooting.
I helped pull out the people that I could from the front, but alas, I had 8 people in the back. One fortunately survived. 7 of my congregants were shot dead in my sanctuary. My holy place has been defiled.
The Anti-Defamation League, which has tracked hatred and violence against Jews since the 1970s, says Saturday's massacre at the synagogue was the worst attack against the Jewish community in U.S. history. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti is in Pittsburgh, and she tells me how the city's Jewish community is coping in the aftermath of the attack.
Well, this is a very tight-knit community. It seems like everyone knows someone who was affected by this shooting, or they know one of the 11 victims. This is a neighborhood in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that's called Squirrel Hill. And it has for years, generations, has been a Jewish community with the synagogue at its center. Now, this synagogue was unique because it was not only attracting the people from the community, but also around the greater Pittsburgh area, because different synagogues had seen their numbers in the congregation waning, and so they were taking in people who were coming for Saturday morning Shabbat services. So there were 3 different services going on within this building from synagogues around the Pittsburgh area. And that's why they were so close-knit. Every Saturday, the same people would show up at these services, and they knew each other. They knew each other so well for going years and years together. I talked with one man, and he said he always welcomed me at the door. He was so excited to see me, and we would see each other every week. We would update each other on our families. But other than Temple, they didn't know each other. So, you know, then you'll find people on the street in Squirrel Hill that knew the community members that were killed by greeting them. Their kids went to school with their children. They babysat their children. They would be teachers in their schools. They were doctors who took care of their entire family. So everyone knows someone.
Yeah, it must just be just really devastating. But well, what is the status of the gunman, Robert Bowers?
He is scheduled to be in court. He is facing 29 federal charges, and prosecutors want to go after the death penalty for him. Now, you remember, he was injured in this gun battle. He spent 2 nights in the hospital and was released this morning so that he could appear in court. Now, in the United States, because we are talking about federal charges, the U.S. Attorney General has to sign off on this death penalty plea, which in all conventional wisdom thinks that he will do so. But the prosecutors have to appeal to him, the highest lawmaker in the land, in order to go after the death penalty for Robert Bowers. He is 46 years old. He has been known for social media posts under his name that have been anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish. As he went into the synagogue, he yelled, "Kill all the Jews," and other terrible language against the Jewish religion, Jewish people. And so these charges against him are federal charges, and they do involve hate crime.
Is President Trump going to be visiting this community?
That is a great question, Sarah. President Trump immediately said he did want to visit this community, but there have been people within this community that have written a letter this morning to him asking him not to come. until he cools down what they call his rhetoric. So there is a push and pull in this community. Some want him to visit. Some want him to help them heal. Others say, others blame President Trump for upping the ante in this country of for anti-tolerance. So you do have kind of battling influences here, and it's yet to be seen whether or not the president does visit the Pittsburgh community, specifically Squirrel Hill, where this Tree of Life synagogue is located.
Yeah, it's just such a sad story.
Oh, it is. I mean, awful. On so many levels, so many levels. I mean, everyone you meet has been touched by this. It just, the outpouring at the interfaith service last night was unbelievable. It was overwhelming for the organizers. 2,300 people fit in that memorial hall, but yet there were thousands outside listening on loudspeakers. They had to pipe out the audio to the people standing outside, and they stood out there for 90 minutes in the rain, in the cooler temperatures, and just wanted to hear from all these religious leaders on how they should go about healing. And it really did help a lot of them. I spoke to a lot of people as they were leaving, and with tears in their eyes, lots of hugs, lots of voices of encouragement for each other. This is a loving community, and they say they will get beyond the hate.
VOA's Carolyn Pursuti reporting from Pittsburgh. Here's some of the top news stories that are trending. A supporter of President Trump is accused of mailing explosives, and he will be appearing in court. 189 people are feared dead after a plane crash in Indonesia. The U.S. envoy to North Korea expresses confidence about denuclearization, and a fear of deportation drives some Rohingya refugees from India. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
In a minute.
Phantom limb pain is described as ongoing painful sensations that seem to be coming from a limb that is no longer there. An amputee advocacy group says that it's thought that nearly 80% of those who have had limbs amputated have experienced this kind of pain. A recent study proposes a new theory for how this mysterious condition may originate. The research is from Max Ortiz Catalan from the Chalmers University of Technology in Sweden. He suggests that after amputation, the nervous system circuitry linked to the prior limb no longer has a job to do. It then can become entangled with another neural network, such as the one responsible for pain perception. Catalan's new theory builds on his work in developing an artificial intelligence-based treatment that addresses phantom limb pain. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the Boston Red Sox win baseball's World Series. Longtime Social Liberal Party lawmaker and former army officer Jair Bolsonaro has been elected Brazil's president.
Foram contabilizados.
The president of the country's superior electoral court, Rosa Weber, said the 63-year-old Bolsonaro emerged from Sunday's second round with 55.54% of the vote to the Workers' Party hopeful Fernando Haddad's 44.46%. His election brings to an end more than a decade of leftist rule. Bolsonaro has been viewed by many as a polarizing figure, with his rhetoric targeting women, homosexuals, and racial minorities, and promises of a harsh crackdown on crime and corruption. It appears voters are prepared to overlook the controversy and give him a chance to end the country's prolonged recession, pervasive crime, and rampant corruption among the political elite. Mark Jones is a political science professor at Rice University in Houston and chairs the Latin American Department. He told International Edition's Victor Beatty this was more about a voter revolt against the political establishment than a vote for Bolsonaro.
And it's also important to place into the context where people were given effectively two suboptimal choices. That is, Fernando Haddad, who is seen as too far to the left, too linked to Lula da Silva, and too linked to the corrupt establishment, and Jair Bolsonaro, who was linked essentially to a host of statements in the past that were homophobic, misogynistic, racist, and is really someone that people are uncertain about what he's going to do once in office.
What's the concern about human rights under a Bolsonaro administration?
There's widespread fear across the world that under Jair Bolsonaro, we'll see a severe erosion in political rights and civil liberties in Brazil, and the country transit towards a more authoritarian form of government, like we've seen in places such as Turkey, Russia, and Venezuela.
The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court did an unexpected and extraordinary thing. He read out part of the Constitution to reporters after he voted. He said the future president must respect institutions, democracy, rule of law, judiciary branch, national Congress, and legislative branch. Is there a concern that he'll return Brazil to a military dictatorship?
I don't think there's a belief that he's going to return to a military-controlled government, but there is a fear that he's going to effectively concentrate power in the executive branch and begin to not respect all of Brazil's constitution.
Mr. Bolsonaro, Mark, was elected despite the political establishment in Brazil urging voters to vote against him.
Some of the political establishment on the center, left, and left urged for a vote against Bolsonaro, but many of the more traditional right-wing parties and center-right parties, such as the PSDB, the MDB, and the Dems, effectively stayed out of it, signaling to their voters that it was okay to vote for Bolsonaro.
He faces a host of domestic problems, including corruption, crime, and recession.
Without question, the country that he's going to inherit is one that's in dire straits. The economy has been struggling, the political establishment is viewed as corrupt, and there's severe public insecurity with crime rampant throughout urban areas, but also in more rural areas. It's only on the latter area where we have a firm understanding of what Jair Bolsonaro is going to do, and that is he's going to crack down hard on crime, utilizing the military and the federal police far more aggressively and promoting more severe sanctions against criminals. And I would expect things are going to get very tough for many of the drug gangs that control many of Brazil's favelas. They're a form of shantytown.
Mark Jones of Rice University said Bolsonaro will have few allies in the Brazilian legislature, and in order to govern, he will have to form coalitions or, failing that, rule by executive decree. The president-elect, strongly backed by Brazil's evangelical community, vowed to uphold democratic principles, rule by the Bible and the Constitution. He pledged to unite the country, cut bureaucracy, and free up businesses to prosper. German Chancellor Angela Merkel says she will leave politics when her term ends in 2021 in the wake of a defeat by her governing coalition in the second regional election in a month. Voters Sunday in the prosperous state of Hesse rejected Merkel's Christian Democrats and the junior partner in her Berlin government, the Social Democrats. The election defeat in Hesse, which saw the Green Party the biggest winner, raised questions about Merkel's future. Earlier this month, the coalition party saw similar defeats in Bavaria. Reporter Jamie Detmer in London tells me about Merkel's political descent.
It was predictable, by the way, that she wasn't going to stand. Her decision not to stand in December. You know, this is now twice in a month there have been in regional elections here in Germany, in Hesse and Bavaria. And on both of them, the governing coalition, particularly the Conservatives, the Christian Democrats, and their partners, have been hammered. And the pressure was building on her even before this election on Sunday that she would decide not to stand for the chairmanship of the party. Now, she can stay on as chancellor, and she says that she will serve out her term, which ends in 2021. The bigger question is whether she's going to make that. The chances are high that this coalition, which includes Christian Democrats, Social Democrats, etc., could well collapse. There's going to be next year a review by the Social Democrats, the junior partner in the coalition. A lot of the party now want to break away from the coalition because it thinks it's doing them no electoral good. So the overall question is, does Merkel stay on until the end of her term?
And when will that be known?
Well, it won't be known immediately. I mean, they're struggling on. It's come very close to collapse, this national governing coalition, a couple of times this year already, over the migration issue for one, and over a scandal involving a former spy chief. The review is meant to be by the Social Democrats mid next year, but there's already talk among some of the leadership of bringing that forward and to having some kind of roadmap. It's very hard to predict. It's very fluid. What we're seeing really is the centre ground of German politics eroding. It's the former fringe parties that are coming out of this very well. In the western half of the country, the Greens, who performed very well in Hesse on Sunday and also did very well in Bavaria. And on the eastern half and the northeastern half of the country, of course, it's the far-right AfD, the Alternative for Germany, that is doing very well. So as this centre ground erodes, really the pressure is on the establishment parties of both the centre-left and the centre-right to come up with a plan to stop this erosion.
Merkel has been chancellor for many years, and she presided over an economy in Germany that has done very well. But it seems as though, was it the migration issue that has hurt her?
It's not just the migration issue. That is key, and we've got the resonance of that, which, of course, the big crisis started in 2015. But one of the things that voters were saying yesterday was a major factor for them in shaping their vote was their frustration with the infighting and a general feeling of shambles to this governing coalition. What I think one must emphasize, what is fascinating about these two regional elections, is that they were held in two parts of the country that are actually very prosperous and are actually doing very well. Normally, incumbents do well in good economic times. Now, they're not the best of economic times in Germany at the moment, but they are pretty strong. It is a pretty prosperous economy, and even though most of the voters were doing quite well, for example, in Bavaria and Hesse, they decided they did not want to stay with the governing coalition because they didn't feel it really represents them. So it's not just an economic issue. In fact, it isn't an economic issue in these two past regional elections. It's a feeling that there is a decay in the center ground of German politics, and it's not representing people as sufficiently as they want it to. I mean, the knock-on effect to Europe could be great about Merkel's descent. She has been very much the oil that makes the European Union work. There are various challenges coming up for the EU on migration crisis, for example, but also on budgetary matters, on Brexit, etc. And as she's weakened in Germany, it doesn't really help the European Union more widely because she has been the rock.
Jamie Detmer reporting from London. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Since the early 20th century, submarine movies have been a popular genre that reflect the history of the times. World War II gave rise to a number of nerve-wracking submarine thrillers, such as the German Das Boot. Tom Clancy's The Hunt for Red October and Crimson Tide in the 1990s introduced the exciting yet perilous nuclear submarines on both sides of the Cold War. Now, Hunter Killer, a term used to describe the nimble 21st century attack submarines, is the latest entry from filmmaker Donovan Marsh. It focuses on perils at sea and the delicate balance of power in the post-Cold War era. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with lead actor Gerard Butler, who plays American submarine captain Joe Glass.
Fire!
Did we just start a war?
No. But we might have still been the one.
Deep beneath the icy surface of the Arctic Circle, American and Russian submarines are on the verge of war. The Russian president has been abducted by his own people, and the rogue minister of defense is preparing to blame his disappearance on U.S. foul play. The Pentagon orders submarine captain Joe Glass, played by Gerard Butler, to navigate a hunter-killer through treacherously narrow passages deep inside Russian waters to save the Russian president, thwart the coup, and prevent World War III.
Take us along the ocean floor.
Fire! Brace for impact!
Butler tells VOA this multi-layered thriller offers not only a nail-biting plot, but also a technically accurate depiction of how nuclear subs, specifically hunter killers, would engage in 21st century warfare.
I went out in the USS Houston from Pearl Harbor on the same submarine as the commander who commanded that submarine wrote the book, Firing Point, which we based our story on.
The actor says the U.S. Navy and Department of Defense were instrumental in ensuring the technical accuracy of the film, including the language used by military personnel and the depiction of a hunter-killer's battle maneuvers.
They gave us their technical team and their engineers to help with our production teams.
The movie crew spent 3 days with the submarine crew underwater, filming real exercises in a contained area on board.
And it's full of leaks, and these leaks come out. It's with such pressure, and it's freezing, and you go in there, and you learn how to fix things under pressure, and we immediately, this thing fills up with water, and you're, next minute you're underwater trying to fix leaks. It's terrifying.
And then there was the man overboard exercise, where the 8,000-ton nuclear submarine spins and maneuvers in choppy waters to save a man overboard before he freezes to death. Butler says the training did not involve an actual human, but a fully cooked bag of popcorn.
They throw the popcorn in the water, and you spend the next 4 minutes trying to save this bag of popcorn, because it takes about 4 minutes for it to rip apart.
Filmmaker Donovan Marsh says a set was built on a massive hydraulic platform, allowing it to move like a submarine.
So there's 35 tons and 50 people on this set,
and you've got to hold on. And I wanted the actors to be able to do that without having to, you know, fake it.
Technical details aside, the lead actor says Hunter Killer engages the audience with a SEAL team rescue operation of the Russian president on Russian soil, an underwater cat-and-mouse submarine maneuver in the Arctic Ocean, and life-and-death decisions being made inside the Pentagon war room.
Torpedoes in the water!
Ship ready!
Solution ready!
Weapon ready!
5 seconds, sir.
Fire!
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks, Penelope. Well, International Edition does not usually include sports stories, but today I'm making an exception for the top team in baseball. I partly grew up in the Boston area, and the Red Sox have been my team since childhood. The Boston Red Sox won their fourth World Series championship in 15 years, beating the Los Angeles Dodgers 5-1 in Game 5 Sunday night. This song, Dirty Water, by the Standells, is usually played locally to honor Red Sox victories. Alex Cora became the first manager from Puerto Rico to guide a team to the title. After posting a team record 108 wins in the regular season and romping through the American League playoffs, the Red Sox finished off a one-sided series. Boston officials Monday announced plans for a parade and rally to take place on Wednesday after the Red Sox return from Los Angeles. Congratulations, guys, and to Boston itself. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.